For a bonus weekend podcast, we wanted to pay tribute to Leonard Cohen and Gwen Ifill, who both died this past week. Leonard Cohen, the Canadian poet and novelist, didn't start his music career as a singer-songwriter until 1967, when he was 33, but he has become an internationally beloved musician. I spoke to him back in 1993. And Gwen Ifill, the Peabody Award-winning longtime host of PBS's Washington Week and co-anchor of PBS NewsHour, died at the age of 61 after a months-long battle with cancer. We were lucky to have had the chance to interview her for her book, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama, and that was in January 2009. Enjoy.
Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river. You can hear the boats go by. You can spend the night beside her. And you know that she's half crazy, but that's why...
Leonard Cohen says his plan was to make a record, make some money, and go back to writing books. But the album was a hit, and some of Mr. Cohen's songs, like Suzanne, Hey, That's No Way to Say Goodbye, Bird on the Wire, Chelsea Hotel, and So Long, Marianne, have sidetracked a career ever since. In fact, he's known today as a singer-songwriter. Pantheon has just published a collection of his work from 1956 through last year entitled Stranger Music, Selected Poems and Songs, and simultaneously Vintage is reissuing Beautiful Losers, his novel from the early 60s. Mr. Cohen joins me now on Yerkin Company. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Couldn't you have continued to write books anyway? Does the pop life just take over?
I never felt that I was seized or by any life. I muddled and continued to blacken pages and write tunes. I never had a strategy.
Mm-hmm. Well, writing songs and singing them wasn't exactly a detour, even then, because you'd already performed with a country music trio, the Buckskin Boys. And
yeah, we put together a small country trio when I was at college.
And you've also suggested that you're always a songwriter, no matter what you're writing. You said once, all of my writing has guitars behind it, even the novels.
I never thought that there was a... of course, obviously, there are distinctions between different kinds of writing, but I always thought that that's what I was doing, mm-hmm. was writing.
But how did that come about? You grew up in Montreal in the 40s mm-hmm. and the 50s. Mm-hmm. You were already in your 20s by the time Elvis even came on the scene. What were you listening to that you would be hearing guitars and thinking about becoming a singer?
Well, I played in bands all through high school, and there was a kind of music culture in Montreal, and there was a lot of country music in Montreal. You know, there were buses that used to go down from Montreal to Nashville on pilgrimages.
I've always wondered about that connection with country music in Canada.
Mm-hmm. There's strong country music in Canada, and some, you know, singers like Hank Snow mm-hmm. Come from Canada. And there's always been a strong country music. There's always been country clubs in Montreal, and you could always get WWVA Wheeling, West Virginia. Mm-hmm. You were always able to get that radio station late at night. So we heard a lot of country. And there weren't too many people interested in country.
So the detour wasn't just from being a novelist and poet into being a singer-songwriter, but also from being somebody interested in country music and into being somebody identified with, I don't know what we call it, folk rock or art rock, something of that sort.
Yes, I was. I'd written a couple of novels and three or four books of verse. And although they'd received very appreciative reviews, I couldn't make a living. So I was on my way down to Nashville. I'd borrowed some money, and I was going to go down there. In hindsight, it seems to be the height of folly. I was going to go down and become a singer in Nashville, or a songwriter, or a studio musician, and try to make a living that way. On the way down, I'd been in Greece for 8 or 9 years, and I didn't know what was happening. On the way down, I stopped off in New York City, and I was introduced to a whole lot of singers who subsequently became very well-known indeed, like Bob Dylan and Phil Oakes and Joan Baez and Judy Collins. And in fact, I found myself in the midst of that of that so-called folk song renaissance.
And talk to Judy Collins about her recording some of your songs.
We had a mutual friend, and I sang a couple of songs for her. She didn't really like them, but she liked the direction they were going in. And she said, you know, if you come up with anything else, I'd like to hear the song. So actually, my money ran out in New York because I didn't know anything was happening here. I was staying at the Chelsea Hotel, and finally I had to go back to Montreal. And I finished that song that you heard a piece of just now, Suzanne, and I phoned Judy Collins from Montreal, and I sang it to her over the phone. And she said, I want to put it on my next album.
And that became the hit on the album, didn't it?
That became, it was a very good album, but that was a song gained a certain amount of favor. And it came to the ears of John Hammond, that legendary A&R man at Columbia, who had signed everyone from Billie Holiday to Dylan. And he invited me out for lunch down on 23rd Street. There's a restaurant no longer exists there. It was called the White Horse. Not the White Horse, but...
The White Horse is in the Village.
Yeah, no, that was the other one. Yeah, anyways, I played him a few tunes, and he said, you got it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was an ambiguous affirmation. I didn't know whether they meant the traffic or the right to call myself or to number myself in this company that he'd selected for Columbia Records.
But you were 33, in fact.
I was not a boy. I was not a boy.
Yeah, and the album was called The Songs of Leonard Cohen. The emphasis in the title is on the songs, not the performer. And that must have been intentional.
Well, that's coming from a literary background, The Songs of Leonard Cohen. It's not really a catchy title. It is just just the facts.
Mm. Yeah, but it's not Leonard Cohen sings, or Cohen or something
no,
like that.
No.
But rather, it's as though you were just simply there to present the songs.
Well, I don't want to claim any virtue from this or sense of modesty. That seemed to be the title of the album. It seemed to be.
I just was wondering whether you felt a bit uncomfortable presenting yourself as a singer at first. Some
at
people
first,
do
didn't.
Have a problem.
At first, I didn't because I'd sung, you know, and I'd been in country groups and I'd been a musician for a long time. It was after the record came out that people began questioning my right to sing. Critics from different points of view questioned my right to be a singer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's never stopped until quite recently when I've now become again hailed as a stylist.
People have joked about the vocal range. One admirer, in fact, in an article that is just totally full of praise, described your style as your vocal range is slightly more than a doorbell. If your friends say things like that, you have to wonder.
Well, I do have a very well. I don't know.
Well, do you feel limited by that when you're writing a song? Do you write for? Obviously, you're not writing for Sarah Vaughan. You're writing for somebody who can sing within an octave.
Yeah. Well, when I wrote a song, for instance, like "Song of Bernadette," I would never attempt to sing that song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jennifer Warren sings it beautifully. Aaron Neville sings it beautifully. There are songs that I've written that I wouldn't try to sing.
Mm-hmm.
The ones I try to sing, yeah, I do like to keep them in about a five-note range.
And then you listen to other people perform them, and that's interesting. Again, I wonder what your feeling is when you hear somebody else sing "Bird on a Wire," for example.
Well, I immediately go into a state of suspended critical suspension. You know, when anybody covers a tune of mine, I completely affirm it. I never listen with that critical point of view, you know, that look what they've done to my song, Ma.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. I almost every cover I've ever heard of one of my tunes, something in me has affirmed.
It felt good in a way to hear somebody finding something different in it.
Well, there have been people who've brought the songs to life, and later on it's been easier for me to sing them.
Mm-hmm. So how do you see yourself these days, as a singer-songwriter or as a poet or as somebody who might wind up writing another novel in the near future?
I've always just felt like someone who's, you know, lifted up his voice in some way. I never really had any loyalty to any particular description.
Mm-hmm. Even the early poems that we find in this book have a certain song lyric
quality to them. The rhythms of these poems are very song-like, and I suspect that you wrote them with that in mind, whether you had a melody or not.
It's true. Well, it's like the Psalms, you know. The actual Hebrew word for Psalms means, you know, piece set to lute music. You know, that's the way I felt about all my work, that it's somehow been set to a musical setting.
My guest is Leonard Cohen, selected poems and songs from 1956 through last year have just been published by Pantheon under the title Stranger Music, and then one of his best-known novel of the two, Beautiful Losers, has just been reissued by Vintage as well. It's interesting that you mention the Psalms, because two basic themes that run through your songs and your poems are sex or problems with love and sex and religion. And even though you're Jewish and you write God sometimes with a G-D, Jesus often appears in your work as well.
Well, I grew up in a very Catholic city. I grew up in a city that is very religious. It certainly was when I was growing up. As somebody observed, a city of minorities and a city with a kind of siege mentality. You know, the French because they were a minority in Canada, the English because they were a minority in Quebec, and the Jews because they were a minority everywhere. And there was a great deal of respect and distance that was established between these various religions, because it was Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish. They were kind of armed camps, though, but with a kind of benign interface.
It's interesting to see how Mordechai Richler reacted to that experience as a child,
mm-hmm.
Very differently than you did. In your way was to incorporate it at all instead of just see yourself as part of one of the small groups.
He's turned out to be a great defender of English rights, English language rights in Montreal, for which everyone is quite grateful, mm-hmm. because the level of political correctness in Quebec makes what's going down here like kindergarten. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean,
multiculturalism is a bigger issue there than
well,
is here.
You know, in Montreal, in Quebec, signs have gone up. You know, you can't put an English sign up mm-hmm. on the street. It's a part of Canada. You cannot conduct your business in English if there's more than so many people. Mm-hmm. You can't display a bilingual sign on the interior of a store unless the English is considerably smaller, unless the actual letters are smaller than the French letters. I mean, this is, you know, in most places this would be called fascism. Mm-hmm. And very few people have raised this point. And Mordechai Richler has raised the point very, very eloquently in a number of articles and has embarrassed the regime.
Mm-hmm. Well, you maintain roots. You live in Los Angeles most of the time, but you live in Montreal as well.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you're living in a fascist city when you're there?
No, because, I mean, one affirms this whole victory of the French-speaking majority. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't help but affirm it. It's just that, you know, in the celebration of their victory, they definitely have gone overboard and violated constitutional rights.
And now with the election, the recent election, with the Quebec Separatist Party being the second largest party in the Canadian Parliament, you'd expect to see even more things happening in that direction.
Well, Quebec voters are very, very sophisticated, and they have always maintained a very, very curious kind of tension between threatening to secede and pulling out at the last moment. Mm-hmm. And this has been a kind of seesaw activity with which they have guaranteed their status in a sometimes hostile environment, because, you know, we are only, you know, 6 million people who speak a different language in the whole continent. So, you know, certain kinds of extreme measures have to be taken to protect that minority.
Mm-hmm. Well, you don't. You speak French, I'm sure, but
yeah.
You never write in French.
No.
Your work, one of the reasons why I think it touches people so strongly is it seems like there is a strong autobiographical element, or rather honest autobiographical element. Is that true?
Or, yeah,
I mean, you're not like
large.
You're not somebody who's inventing personae for each song, are you?
No, I've never worked out of any kind of position of luxury in any case. You know, I've never felt that I've been at a buffet table kind of choosing, you know, what form or what position to take. I always feel, you know, I'm at the bottom of the barrel, scraping the bottom of the barrel, just trying to finish the damn thing, you know, trying to put it together with Band-Aids and chicken wire, just trying to stitch the whole thing together, and it's falling apart.
And you've said that a number of your best-known songs were really unfinished. You just had to let them go at a certain point, like Bird on a Wire.
Well, Bird on the Wire I keep working on, and on the new album I've just finished mixing, there is a substantially different version of it.
Melody-wise or just lyric-wise?
Well, the melody has changed a lot, but the words have changed too.
Mm-hmm. The first album was a giant success.
Mm-hmm.
The second album did well, and then, at least in this country, despite the fact that, would there have been 11 altogether?
Something like that, yeah.
And quite a few books as well. For most people, you still are the guy who wrote Suzanne. Is that a terrible trap?
Not really, because the people who come to my concerts, there's not multitudes, but I always manage to sell the few halls I play. Those people have kept up with what I've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
Of course.
But you've had more of a career in Europe than you have in the United States.
More of a career in Europe, and it changes, you know. Sometimes I get wiped out in all the civilized countries, you know, and it's only in Poland where I'm popular. In fact, mm-hmm. in Poland, I'm most popular. It's the most popular country that I have, you know, Poland.
Mm-hmm.
And they pay me in zlotys. You know, you can't get them out of the country.
So what do you do? Buy a lot of hams and bring them?
No,
back,
I have little scholarships and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there's always been some obscure corner of the world where I've been able to, you know, fill a hall. So I'm very happy with the way my so-called career has gone. And just recently, Canada has begun to embrace me with a vengeance.
Why do you think now?
Well, I'm getting to be a safe age, you know, and
not hurt by all of the talk of a relationship with Rebecca De Mornay, I suspect.
Oh, I don't. In some circles, that's not considered. You know, I've always kind of fallen between the cracks of the pop world and the literary world. You know, certain kind of people don't like my association with Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certain kinds of people don't like my association with pop music. Certain kinds of people don't like my relationship with the literary element. You know, I've lived a very particular and I might say very free kind of life in between these two camps. You know, sometimes mostly being ignored by most of them, but sometimes with a kind of modest respect from both of them too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm surprised that Canada hasn't been prouder of you all along. After all, Canada does seem to be pleased that so many of its very small population have gone on to great fame throughout the world.
Well, they've been very kind to me for the past couple of years, but I think it's a kind of good idea to be left alone
mm-hmm.
by those people who affirm and give awards and that sort of thing. I think it's better to be left alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been left alone, by and large. In fact, I've been ignored by a lot of elements. But as I say, I've been able to make a living, you know, and I've been able to pay my credit cards. I've been able to send my kids to school, and I've been able to go where I want it.
Well, the difference, I suspect, here than in Europe is that here it'll always be Leonard Cohen's greatest hits, because the way we discovered you initially was
mm-hmm.
with the release of these different songs.
Mm-hmm.
There probably came later, and it got a little more jumbled. So the later work was equal to the early work. Does that make any sense?
The very last couple of records I've done have kind of revived my career in a number of countries. Mm-hmm. Some places I'm still wiped out. Some places I've come back in, you know. But there's always some people here and there that want to hear the work.
But do you ever regret that you wrote Suzanne? Because
no.
It's a song people always want you to sing, no matter what.
No, it's a good tune, and I'm singing it, you know, about an octave and a half lower than the version you just heard.
You've included that in with all of these other song mm-hmm. lyrics and poems. Mm-hmm. This is pretty much the best things you've done since 1956?
A lot of people have quarreled with the selection, especially in Canada, where my early books of poems are well known, and the suggestion is that I left out too much material from the very early books.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's true. I think it's a pretty solid collection, and I think it's a good read.
How many altogether? Because this is quite a large book. It's a very generous collected.
It's over 400 pages, something like that.
Mm-hmm. It includes most of the songs that people identify with you, and a lot of poems that they may or may not know from previous books.
Well, I think
books.
That books like Energy of Slaves mm-hmm. and Death of a Ladies' Man, which were actually published here, but were never reviewed and actually never sold. So I'm happy to have those books out again.
And Beautiful Losers, after all these years, do you think it holds up for you?
Well, I think it's pretty good, that book, you know. Mm-hmm. It's been reissued here and in England and in Canada. And I don't read it very often, but sometimes I'll take, when I was making selections from it for this book, I read it. It is alive.
Mm-hmm. But doesn't tempt you to write another novel?
Well,
have you come
know.
So far
the
from regi- what inspired you?
The regime
you
of writing a novel is pretty good. Maybe I'm getting back to that. I mean, you need a place,
mm-hmm.
you know, and a table, and it's good to have someone around, you know, to keep you company. The regime is different.
Mm-hmm. You need to have 4 or 5 hours a day, no matter what.
Well, I need a lot more than that. I mean, you know, I remember saying the lyric of Democracy, which is on my last record. It's a song called Democracy is Coming to the USA. And I said the lyric to Robert Altman, the movie director,
mm-hmm.
who's used my stuff over the years in some of his movies. He said, that's a three-act play. And it's true, and it took me as long as a three-act play to write it. So I don't feel that the forms have been that foreign one from the other. Mm-hmm. I may spend a year on a lyric. I did on Democracy is Coming to the USA and The Future and the lyrics in that record. They were written with the same kind of regime that you would use to write a novel.
Leonard Cohen has published 9 books of poetry, 2 novels, made 11 records, and now 2 books have just been published, one a paperback reissue of Beautiful Losers by Vintage, and in hardcover, selected poems and songs from 1956 to the present under the title Stranger Music, and that's published by Pantheon.
It's very kind of you to give me such a long plug.
Well, people will listen to this and wonder where they can find the book and what the book is, and I think I should tell them.
Thank you very much.
And I thank you for having been on our show.
On the wire, like a drunk.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The election of Barack Obama has been described as the completion of the long-held dreams of the civil rights movement, but he has often parted ways with the older generation of black politicians, and He's not alone. In her new book, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama, Gwen Ifill looks at how Obama is one of many younger black politicians who have been succeeding at the ballot box. Her book is published by Doubleday, and I'm delighted that it brings Gwen Ifill to the show today. Hi.
Thrilled to be here.
What was it about this election cycle that you think made Barack Obama think he had a chance to break through?
I'd love to get inside Barack Obama's head sometime and find out the answer to the question, because it was entirely improbable. When I decided to write this book, I had no idea that Barack Obama could be president. In fact, I think I was one of those people who said, oh, that'll never happen. But on the other hand, I really had this opportunity to write a book about him and what he represented, not just about him. So whether he won or not, I thought, I'll still be able to write about what he represents.
And you don't just write about him. You also profile Newark Mayor Cory Booker, Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, Congressman Artur Davis of Alabama, and you mention many more.
Mm-hmm.
So what makes a politician a breakthrough candidate these days?
I think it's when they're willing to do something improbable, even when they're told it's not their turn. Even when they're told, well, yeah, that's fine. You'll be good at some point in this job. But I, the person who hold the power, I'm not giving it up quite yet. And they have to succeed at it. And there are a lot of people who run for office and don't get elected, and that doesn't quite do it.
Well, how important is the way they handle the race issue for their being a breakthrough candidate?
Well, the one thing these guys and some women have in common is that they don't deny that race is an issue. They don't say we've transcended race. They don't buy into that because it's kind of a flawed and easily disproved notion. But they do, I guess some would say, downplay race. They don't make it the driving force of their reason to run for whatever they're running for. They find a way to, if it's possible in this country, neutralize race. And that's what Barack Obama did. That's what all the rest of them do, in a way that doesn't then alienate black voters as well.
Well, Barack Obama didn't mention Martin Luther King during the convention in his acceptance speech, and it was the day after.
Called him a Georgia preacher. Yeah. And we were left to assume what he was talking about.
So is that downplaying the achievements of the civil rights movement?
No, it's definitely what it's doing is, in order to be elected in this kind of coalition environment where you're reaching across all kinds of lines that previously existed, you have to make voters say, reduce the different distance between you and voters. So to call attention to how you're different is not how you get elected. You have to call attention to how much you're the same, and that's what all these guys and women are doing.
Do you think that these politicians, the ones you describe as breakthroughs, appreciate being grouped together? Do they see themselves as members, as people with a common philosophy, the way the preceding generation did?
They do. I have to say, I didn't feel like I had to force the definition on anyone. In fact, more often than not, when I started to tell people what I thought my premise was, they would say, oh, I've been thinking about this. Funny you should ask. And not only the politicians themselves, but the people around them, sometimes their spouses, sometimes people who had thought about, who had been involved in politics, white people who have been involved in politics, all said, you know, funny you should mention that. And they all know each other, not necessarily well, but they study each other. A lot of these folks are studying quite closely what happened with Barack Obama and trying to figure out whether it applies in Alabama, say, or other venues.
He used the word sandpaper a lot here, sandpaper moments, sandpaper mm-hmm. politics. What do you mean by that?
It's what happens when power shifts. Power concedes nothing without a demand, Malcolm X said, and that's exactly what happened here. In so many cases, in order for these elected officials to break through, they had to say, I'm going to take that. Julian Bond once said that to some young people who were complaining that they didn't think they got enough prominence at a civil rights march in 1993. And he said to them, if you perceive I have something that you want, it's your job to snatch it from me. And that's what these breakthrough politicians have to do.
Well, in many cases, they're snatching it from other black politicians. In the 1980s, there were certain things that consolidated the gains of the civil rights movement, and that led to a very powerful generation of black politicians.
A handy way to look at it is to look at the Congressional Black Caucus. Many of them are in office because they come from districts which are carved out specifically because of legal advances that allow them to redistrict to help them get elected black districts. So many of these breakthrough candidates are breaking through in diverse areas. And so they're taking advantage of the laws that were passed, Voting Rights Act, and all sorts of things that were passed to allow them, public accommodations law, to get where they get. But then they move past it. They're no longer protesting. They're not sitting at lunch counters. They're taking the next step beyond the legal gains.
Although they are, in many cases, running against that earlier generation of black politicians.
Yeah, those are the ones who, from whom you have to snatch the baton instead of having them give it up.
Now, Colin Powell decided not to run for president in 1996. Do you think that race was a factor in that decision?
He says it was. He actually said an interesting thing that his white friends would say, "You've got to run, you've got to run." And his black friends would say, "They're not going to let a colored guy have this job." And his wife actually thought and felt strongly at that time that it would not be safe yet for a black man to run in such a high-profile position.
And he offered the objections of his wife, the concerns of his wife, as a good reason for not running. So what happened in the intervening 12 years?
Well, part of it is the right person has to come along. Colin Powell really didn't have the fire in his belly to be president, to run for president. It takes a lot to be able to do that. And it took a while. In the interim, you know, before Colin Powell had run, we had seen Jesse Jackson run twice. He had fire in his belly, but of a different sort. And then it took a Barack Obama or someone improbable to just break through the clutter.
My guest is Gwen Ifill, and her latest book is The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. It's published by Doubleday. We tend to ignore divisions within the black community, especially economic divisions. Does that affect the way that we understand the success of these politicians?
I don't know if we ignore it. I do think that we pay far more attention to the divisions between races than what's happening within races. There is a real I saw an interesting survey earlier this year where, in fact, if just among black voters, they were asked about whether they thought there was a difference between in class and within the black community. And the people who felt most strongly about that were poor people, not rich people saying they're not like us. It was poor people saying they're not like us.
Well, to a large degree, in the Democratic primaries, we were looking at the clash between gender politics and racial politics. Mm-hmm. But nobody talked about class politics. And in fact, when Barack Obama was involved in the debates with John McCain, he only talked about the middle class.
And that's all he is a politician in the end. Let's not lose sight of that. And that's all any of them ever talk about, the middle class. They talk about the group that's most likely to turn up and vote. But that said, the more compelling and driving decisions were made this year, not based on race and not based on class, but I think based on generation. That was the real breakthrough in so many ways. These candidates have a lot in common, many of them, but what they really have in common when you slice it down is that either they are of a certain age in which they speak to younger people or they appeal, despite their age, to younger people.
Is it a coincidence that Congressman Arthur Davis, Cory Booker, and Barack Obama all ran and lost, at least in their first runs, against older established black politicians?
I don't think it's a coincidence at all. I think it happens a lot with new politicians of every stripe, that you have to run and lose to learn how to run. Bill Clinton always says that he learned how to lose and how to run by losing first. And so a lot of them do that. But what your point, which is that a lot of these guys had to unseat folks who had the power, who held the reins in order to break through themselves.
And they had to present themselves as something different, not just a younger black politician. Mm-hmm. Their goals usually were reformer goals.
They were, but then the real hard part starts after you get elected, because they were able to break through. They were able to take that seat from the old guy and say, "I'm going to change the way it's been done." But then after they got there, in the case of Cory Booker, in the case of Deval Patrick, there were a lot of stumbles right out of the gate.
But Deval Patrick was not running against a black politician. Cory Booker had run against Sharp James, who pretty much ran Newark as a political boss for couple of generations.
It's true, but he only won the second time because Sharp James stepped aside. It wasn't like he ran against Sharp James, even though...
And there was a lot of scandal swirling around
exactly.
Sharp James.
Well, and the candidate he beat was a Sharp James candidate. But in the end, he still got into office and had to deal with all the same entrenched power structures in the city.
And Sharp James ran against Cory Booker, to some degree, on racial issues. He described him as a white black man.
I know. And there was there's a case in Alabama. Artur Davis, Al Sharpton, came to campaign against him when he was running against Earl Hilliard, who was an entrenched black incumbent. And he said, "Everyone who's our color is not our kind." Raised lots of questions, a lot of similarities in the way a lot of these entrenched politicians treated those two.
Is that why a lot of the older generation politicians supported Hillary Clinton rather than Barack Obama at first?
I think that was more about loyalty and friendship. There are a lot, for instance, I talked to Ron Dellums, who's now the mayor of Oakland and was a longtime congressman. He talked a lot to the Obama people, but he supported the Clinton people in the end because he knew them better. For a lot of these old guys, they looked at Barack Obama and said, "Who are you?" It's like the old Chicago line, you know, "I don't want nobody, nobody sent." They didn't know who he was, and he wasn't doing a lot of wooing.
What about among white voters? Was there also a generational divide?
There was a huge generational divide, but far less of the early stutter step that you saw among black voters, where black voters said, "I don't know this guy, I don't know," until he won. Once he won with white voters in Iowa, then black voters said, "Okay, I can do this," and they started supporting him in South Carolina. White voters, in lots of ways, were on board earlier.
Partly because, in some cases, the younger voters convinced their parents that they should support Barack Obama.
Absolutely, and got out and knocked on doors and backed it up.
Vernon Jordan told you that between the two generations of black political leaders, there's not much laying on of hands now.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
He means that somehow, at some point, it's a responsibility of the older generation to select, recruit, lift up the next generation, and that wasn't happening. He didn't know whether that wasn't happening because the younger folks weren't asking it for it or the older folks weren't giving it.
I get the feeling he blames the younger generation.
No, actually, it's a little bit the opposite. He remembers that he stepped aside as leader of the Urban League before he was taken out on a litter. I mean, he thinks that a lot of black leaders of traditional civil rights organizations hold on too long, and that's where the problem begins.
Well, Jesse Jackson was shown with tears streaming down his face at Grant Park mm-hmm. on election night, but he had also expressed reservations about Obama during the campaign, and that's putting it mildly.
You know, I think Jesse Jackson is a perfect example that it is possible for people to hold two thoughts in their heads at one time. I think Jesse Jackson was perfectly proud to see Barack Obama break through and get the job that he had run for twice and not quite made. But at the same time, he didn't express it elegantly, obviously, his objections to Barack Obama.
You mean cutting Obama's nuts off?
Oh, you said it. Yeah, I'm trying to avoid saying it out loud, but yeah, that's what he said. But what he was saying when he said that was, "I get so angry that he's not speaking for poor people." He felt that Obama was missing an opportunity to be a spokesman for a class which is not spoken for.
And to some degree, that has been the role of the older generation of black politicians following for Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
What Barack Obama did instead is he tried to broaden the scope, and the older politicians saw him the way they'd seen Cory Booker as acting too white.
There are a couple of ways of looking at this, which is, do you want to get elected or do you want to be a protester? The Barack Obamas of the world and all of these people who fit into this generation say, if I get elected, I can then fix health care. If I fix health care, I then fix health care for the disproportionate share of African Americans and people of color who suffer from bad health care. So then that way, it's a different way in, but this is how I'm helping my community.
Well, Jesse Jackson has publicly clashed with his own son, the Illinois Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. at time. Why didn't you include Jesse Jackson Jr. as a breakthrough candidate? Is it because he's the heir of a political legacy?
I thought his story was more interesting as a legacy story because the contrast between him and his father just seemed to be so interesting to me. Also, it was unclear to me, the one thing about, I had pretty loose definitions about what breakthrough candidates were, but they had to be on a trajectory that was clear to me. And it wasn't clear to me that Jesse Jackson Jr. was moving to the next step quite yet.
My guest is Gwen Ifill, moderator and managing editor of Washington Week, senior correspondent for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. And she's written a book called The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. It's published by Doubleday. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Gwen Ifill. Her book, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama, is published by Doubleday. We've been talking about this generational divide. Do you think that the generational divide helped Obama with white voters? Because they have seen the older generation of black voters as being so specifically aimed at black causes.
I do think that Barack Obama managed to do an interesting thing that a lot of these other candidates have done, which is he short-circuited white guilt. There are a lot of white folks who are uncomfortable even to this day in talking about Barack Obama as even being black. I've gotten mail from people saying, why can't we just ignore that he's black? Well, why would we? What's wrong with it? What's wrong with it, of course, is it makes life uncomfortable for whites who were really not used to talking about race in a way that is absent conflict.
Well, there was that whole matter of his speech about race after the Reverend Jeremiah Wright controversy, and I know many of his advisors recommended him just ignoring it, but that speech may very well have been a turning point in his campaign.
I think that was one of his best speeches, and I think they knew they couldn't ignore it, and that's the only reason he gave that speech. They would have preferred that he never directly spoke about race. He knew, if you read his first book, you know he spent more time thinking about race and racial identity than any of us. He knew he had to. And that's what that was about. It was either that or he was going to be buried under the suspicion and the nervousness about difference that the Jeremiah Wright controversy kind of brought out.
Well, how did he address race throughout the campaign? Did it change depending on his audience?
He didn't much address it if he didn't have to. His approach seemed to be, you know, I'm black. There's nothing new about it. And every time he would mention it, like he made a joke once about how he didn't look like everybody in the dollar bill, and immediately a huge blog, you know, backlash happened about it. How dare he mention race as if somehow he had committed some crime. So he just learned to stay away from it because, more than anything else, he didn't want another distraction. And there was plenty about him that was distracting for people.
Well, what did he say in his speech at Ebenezer Baptist Church on Martin Luther King weekend last year? It was just a year ago.
It was literally the anniversary of the speech in which he ended up becoming president. He showed up there, and it was a perfect example, standing in that pulpit, sympathetic black crowd, to say, "Let me talk about us." But instead, he leaned against it, and he talked about he told anecdotes about white voters he'd met along the way, and he leaned away so purposefully from talking about race that I was struck by that.
And as we said earlier, he never mentioned Martin Luther King by name when he accepted the Democratic nomination in Denver, even though it was the 45th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech. Do you think it would have hurt him?
No, I don't think it would have hurt him, actually. I think everyone expected it. It would have been considered to be a perfectly normal thing to do. But there was a certain consistency in what he did that night in saying, you know what, it's obvious. You've seen the entire night had been occupied with tributes to King and other performers who mentioned it. And he just decided to be, even on the night in Grant Park when he accepted, when he won, he talked about the arc of history through the eyes of a 105-106-year-old black woman, but he didn't talk about it in terms of racial landmarks. He talked about the invention of the automobile. He talked about other more common landmarks that we all share, and that's the way he talks about race.
And he did that in the inaugural address as well.
That's right.
Any president, new president, could have given that speech, at least in terms of race.
I think anybody who was going to be the first black president of these United States was going to have to find a way to, whenever he talked about race, put it in a broader context.
Well, you interviewed him in the middle of the Reverend Wright controversy. What did he tell you?
He was a little rattled by it. This was the day before the race speech and when they had just decided they were going to go to Philadelphia and give it. And he really thought that what at that point he was calling Reverend Wright, that what he had said was stupid. It was a time when publicly he was kind of dancing around denouncing his pastor. He had given him a lot of ways he felt to get out of this box. But he had reached a point where he could no longer, and even in his race speech, he was very conciliatory toward Jeremiah Wright, who then continued his campaign, and he finally had to cut ties to him.
We talked earlier about gender politics. Shirley Chisholm said that she felt that the fact she was a woman was a much harder hurdle for her when she was running for office.
Partly because when Shirley Chisholm was running for office, she was one of the few women in the Congressional Black Caucus, and the men in the Congressional Black Caucus didn't understand what she was doing. They thought it was a vanity effort for her to run for president. They didn't get along, basically. So she felt it was a sexist reason why they didn't get along. It was interesting.
But then when Sarah Palin was picked, it initially did hurt Obama with women. There was a 20-point swing, and then He wound up winning women by 7% of the vote.
Yeah, it's really, there was an interesting burst of activity, which had more to do with kind of the shock value and the excitement value of the history-making potential of this vice presidential nominee. And then as time went on and things shook out and people got a closer look at her and she had her few significant missteps along the way, things settled back down to about where they'd been.
Political consultants David Axelrod and David Plouffe.
Mm-hmm.
They both worked for Deval Patrick and Barack Obama. Did they apply pretty much the same approach to both races?
Pretty much. It was the same thing with David Plouffe told me that Deval Patrick at one point wanted to give a race speech in Massachusetts, and they talked him out of it. Because they didn't think it was necessary. Now, he didn't have the kind of cauldron of Jeremiah Wright that he had to get out from under.
But so he had a state with only 7% black
vote. And he had a state that was only 7% black vote. So why call attention to it when it's obvious? And, you know, David Plouffe said to me right in the middle of this Jeremiah Wright thing, if this takes us down, then maybe the country wasn't ready.
Well, I guess the thing that has changed is that black politicians, new ones, younger ones, realize that they're always, except in certain districts, they're pretty much always going to be representing a minority, and they'd better broaden their appeal.
Absolutely. That's the only way you survive. This is a country which is increasingly made up of people of color. The majority is certainly going to be people of color soon, but at some point you still have to reach across all these disparate lines, and they find a way to do it.
Well, many of them seem to chafe against being told to wait their turn by the civil rights generation.
And that's the one common thing. They've all been told this, and this is not just the four main characters in the book, but every mayor I talk to, every district attorney, there's an attorney general in the state of Georgia who's the only black attorney general in the entire country, and, you know, he's been told to wait his turn by blacks and whites, and he just keeps plowing ahead.
Well, do you think that in some way has inadvertently helped some of these candidates by creating some distance between them and people like Al Sharpton?
Oh, Artur Davis, the congressman from Alabama who wants to run for governor, knows that if he's going to break through and actually win the governorship in a state that was the cradle of the Confederacy, where George Wallace in my lifetime was saying segregation now and forever, he has got to. It's essential for him to separate himself from the old black power guard, and that's what he's doing.
And he went after the Jewish Democrats.
Absolutely.
So how was he able to work around that powerful black leadership in Alabama?
He just outraised them. He went and raised more money. He found other sources of support. He didn't do the normal thing, and that's what you had to do, create a new base.
Does he have any chance in Alabama? I can't, because people in Alabama still are much, some
tough.
People are much more open in their racial attitudes.
I looked at the exit polls in Alabama after Election Day, and Barack Obama only won 10% of the white vote. Artur Davis is going to have to do a lot better than that if he's going to get elected governor of Alabama.
My guest is Gwen Ifill of PBS. Her book, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama, is published by Doubleday. You also point out that mistakes some of these politicians have made, were a lot of them made because they didn't wait their turn and didn't pay their dues, didn't build up the kind of relationships that older politicians have?
You know, it's a common mistake. We all say we want fresh new faces, and then when we get them, it turns out the reason they're fresh and new is because they've never done it before. So there is a small problem when you're learning on the job. When Bill Clinton first got elected, he also got elected because of a desire for change. Well, when he got into the White House, he stumbled out of the gate on gays in the military and three or four other things before he got his sea legs. And it's no less true for black politicians than for anybody else.
One caller asks, did Barack Obama's chances improve because he had a white mother?
I don't know. I don't know. It depends how much.
Mixed race is a real problem for some people in this country.
Well, and it's a positive for a lot of people. I've had just as many people ask me, why don't you describe him as biracial? Why do you keep describing him as black? And the answer for me is pretty simple. He describes himself as black. And as long as Don Cheadle, the actor, told Henry Louis Gates for this PBS program, African American Lives, you are what you have to defend. And that's, the congressman Kendrick Meek from Florida said, if I take off my congressional pin and walk down Pennsylvania Avenue, hail a cab, the cabs are still going to pass me by because I'm a black man. So since as long as that's the way Barack Obama describes himself, even though he, with great affection and obviously honor for his white mother, he describes himself as African American, why shouldn't we?
There's another factor in the way people self-identify.
Mm-hmm.
Tiger Woods has talked about a much more complicated relationship to that. But often when people are a mixed race, and black is one of the, you know, some African portion of that, as you say, society sees them as black, and they often identify with that culture because the culture is so powerful in our society.
It's true, and it's so much more essential for a politician, because a politician only gets the job if people will vote for them. And people will only vote for you if they see something in you that reminds them of themselves. It's not like Tiger Woods, who's Kablan Asian or however he describes himself. He also feels he doesn't have to depend on votes. He just has his skill with a golf club.
In October, this book actually became news right before the vice presidential debate, which you moderated. Were you surprised that Republicans latched on to the book as a way of trying to discredit you?
I was a little surprised at first, but when I thought about it, I realized that I was just a tool. I was the people were looking for a million different distractions at that point, whether it was a way to buck up Sarah Palin or a way to get inside my head as the moderator and get me to ask different questions. Either way, it didn't work.
But isn't it also part... Doesn't it also deal with something that you're talking about in this book, that people make assumptions based on race?
I don't know a black journalist who hasn't had assumptions made about what their point of view might be toward Barack Obama. And I can't spend a whole lot of time worried about what people think. I just kind of put my nose to the grindstone and do the job.
Well, Katie Couric, that other African-American journalist, caused Sarah Palin a fair amount of trouble, didn't she?
She did, and funny nobody wondered.
Gwen Ifill is moderator and managing editor of Washington Week and senior correspondent of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Her latest book, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama, published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Leonard.